Penguin Random House Canada presents The Hero's Walk by Anita Rao Badami. Read for you by Lara Sadiq.
One. By the edge of the sea. It was only 5 o'clock on a July morning in Thottirpuram, and already every trace of night had disappeared. The sun swelled, molten, from the far edge of the sea. Waves shuddered against the sand and left curving lines of golden froth that dried almost instantly. All along the beach, fishermen towed their boats ashore and emptied their nets of the night's catch. Their mothers and wives, daughters and sisters, piled the prawn and the crab, the lobster and the fish, into large, damp baskets still redolent of the previous day's load, and then, leaving the shimmering scales and cracked shells for the crows to fight over, they caught the first bus to the market, laughing as other passengers hastily moved to the front and made way for them and their odorous wares. In a few hours, the heat would hang over the town in long, wet sheets, puddle behind people's knees, in their armpits and in the hollows of their necks, and drip down their foreheads. Sweaty thighs would stick to chairs and make rude sucking sounds when contact was broken. Only idiots ventured out to work and, once there, sat stunned and idle at their desks because the power had gone off and the ceiling fans were still. It was impossible to bat an eyelash without feeling faint. The more sensible folk stayed at home, clad only in underwear, with moist cloths draped over their heads and chests, drinking coconut water by the liter and fanning themselves with folded newspapers. Even though it was the middle of July in this small town that crouched on the shores of the Bay of Bengal, about 3 hours by bus from Madras, the southwest monsoons that provided a minor interlude between periods of heat had not appeared. So all of Thottirpuram longed for December, when the northeast monsoons would roar in. The memory of those cool, wet mornings was so appealing that everyone forgot that December was also the beginning of the cyclone season, when winds blew at 150 kilometers per hour, smashing everything that stood in their way. They did not remember the torrential rains that knocked out the power lines and plunged the town into stinking liquid darkness. And they utterly forgot how the sea became a towering green wall of water that dissolved the beach and flooded the streets, turning roadways into drains and bringing dysentery and diarrhea in its wake. There was so much rain that septic tanks exploded all over town, and people woke suddenly in the night to find their belongings floating in sewage. Today, the morning light touched the squalid little town with a tenuous beauty. Even the dozens of angular apartment blocks that marched stolidly from the beach up to Big House on Brahmin Street were softened by the early glow. Sheaves of television antennae bristled up from the roofs of those apartments and caught fire as the sun rose. Big House was the only building on the street that did not flaunt one. Sripati Rao, the owner, had reluctantly bought a television set a few years ago, but it was an old model that only had an internal antenna. His mother, Amaya, had been disappointed.
"Nobody will even know we have a television," she protested. "What is the use of having something if nobody knows about it?"
Sripati would not be swayed.
"So long as you get your programs, why does it matter who knows what we have? Besides, this is all I can afford."
"If you had listened to me and become a big doctor, you wouldn't have been talking about affording and not affording at all,"
grumbled his mother. She never missed an opportunity to remind him how much of a disappointment he was to her.
"Even if I was one of the Birlas, I would have bought only this television,"
Sripati had argued. "Or the Tatas, or the Ambanis, or, for that matter, any of India's mighty business tycoons." He did not believe in ostentatious displays of possessions or of emotions. When the phone rang for the first time that day, Sripati was on the balcony of his house. As usual, he had woken at 4 a.m. and was now reading the newspaper, ticking off interesting items with a red marker. He stopped when he heard the high, fractured trill, but made no move to go down to the landing halfway between the first and ground floors to the phone. He waited for someone else to get it. There were enough people around, including, he thought with some annoyance, his son, Arun, asleep in the room across the corridor from his own. Afterwards, Sripathi wondered why he had felt no twinge of premonition. He remembered other times when tragedy had occurred. How uneasy he had been the day before his father's lifeless body was discovered on Andal Street, and how strange the coincidence that had taken him there the next morning, where he had joined the curious crowd gathered around it. And before his beloved grandmother, Shantama, was finally claimed by the Lord of Death, his nights had been full of restless dreams. Weren't disasters always heralded by a moment of immense clarity or a nightmare that rocked you, weeping out of sleep? This time, however, he experienced nothing. The phone continued to ring, grating on Sripathi's nerves.
Arun!
He shouted, leaning back in his chair so that he could see the length of his bedroom through the balcony door.
Get the phone! Can't you hear it?
There was no reply.
Idiot sleeps all his life,
he muttered. He pushed the chair away from the square iron table on which he had arranged his writing material and stood up, flexing his rounded shoulders. As a youth, Sripathi had found that he was taller than all his friends and, because he hated to be different or conspicuous in any way, had developed a stoop. His thick gray hair was cut as short as possible by Shakespeare Kupalur, the barber on Tagore Street. An expression of permanent disappointment had settled on a face dominated by a beaky nose and large, moist eyes. After the softness of the eyes, the thin, austere line of his mouth came as a surprise. Once, during an argument, his wife, Nirmala, had remarked that it looked like a zippered purse. He remembered being taken aback by the comparison. He had always found her to be like a bar of Lifebuoy soap, functional but devoid of all imagination. The thought crossed his mind that the call might be from Maya, his daughter in Vancouver, and he paused in his passage across the bedroom. If it was, he didn't want to answer it. His eyes fell on a photograph of Maya with her foreign husband and their child on the windowsill next to Nirmala's side of the bed, and immediately his mood became tinged with bitterness. Every day, whenever he found an opportunity, he turned the picture face down on the sill and piled some books on it, feeling slightly childish, only to have it reinstated right side up by Nirmala. But Maya phoned on Sunday mornings, he reminded himself. At 6:30, when, as she knew, her mother would be waiting, sitting on the cold tiled floor of the landing right beside the phone. And every Sunday, for several years now, Sripathi had avoided that moment by setting off for a walk at 6:20. His younger sister, Putti, who was also downstairs somewhere, was too scared to answer the phone.
I don't know what to talk into that thing,
Putti had explained to Sripathi once, embarrassment writ large on her round, babyish face.
And anyway, it is never for me.
A sad thing for her to say, he had thought then, feeling guilty that he had not done his duty as her older brother and found a husband for her. After living in Thottirpuram for 42 years, Putti had nobody to call a friend, except perhaps that horrible librarian, Miss Chintamani. Sripathi's mother claimed that she was too old to climb the stairs, but Nirmala insisted Ammaya was a fraud and that she came upstairs regularly to snoop around when she was alone in the house.
She steals my saris, Nirmala had grumbled, and I found my comb under her mattress. Did it walk there by itself or what?
The phone stopped ringing, and silence draped itself around the house once more. Sripathi went back to the balcony and settled down in the faded cane chair that had survived at least 20 years of ferocious sun and rain. He picked up the Hindu again and started to read it carefully, ticking off articles that he wanted to comment on. He could hear soft music emanating from the apartments that loomed beside the house, the thin notes drowned almost immediately by the sound of the Krishna temple bell, a clanging that competed for attention with the nasal call of the mullah from the Thousand Lights Mosque on a parallel street. The temple was straight up the road from Big House, which had been built 82 years ago by Sripathi's grandfather on what came to be called Brahmin Street for the number of people of that caste. However, when the ruling party won the state elections, it decreed that no street could have a name that indicated a particular caste, So Brahman Street was now...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?